The following sermon is presented by Maranatha Bible Church of Comstock Park, Michigan. For more information, go to mbcmi.org.
Would you be so kind as to turn in your copy of the scriptures to Psalm 127? Psalm 127. This will be our destination passage for this morning. Psalm 127. From the New International Version, I read, "Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat. For he grants sleep to those he loves. Sons are a heritage from the Lord, children a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, are sons born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gate." It wasn't long ago that I was in Cleveland, Ohio, and came across an article in the local metropolitan paper known as the Plain Dealer. It was an article about a gentleman in Pennsylvania, but the headline really grabbed me. It said, "Motorist kills deer." Now, we live in Kent County. Let's get real, right? Not a big deal, not hardly worthy of a headline. But this headline went on and really captured my imagination. "Motorist kills deer in fight after collision." In Venango County this week, for the first time, a deer was killed in a street fight. Brian Krepp, 18, a high school student with no known history of either bad temper or bad driving, was on his way home from work late Tuesday night when a large white-tailed buck dashed in front of his car, crumpling the front fender, smashing the grill, and igniting the temper of a young man who hardly knew he had one. At least one like this. Krepp, who stands 6 feet one, weighs in at 240 pounds, got out of the car and got into a hand-to-horn fight with a buck, which weighed only 220 pounds, but even the odds with a 9-point rack of antlers. It ended with the deer dead. Krepp passed out from an asthma attack, and game commission officials issuing a reminder not to try to kill a deer with your bare hands. This game commission spokesman, Bruce Whitman, said, is something the general public is not encouraged to do. Article goes on and says the general public so far hasn't been especially sympathetic to Krepp, who says he never gets into fights and just got very upset when he realized he was going to have to explain the damage to his father's Toyota. It was just an instant reflex kind of thing, like, "You ain't getting away," Krepp said. Krepp gave this account. He got out of the smashed Toyota, his foot throbbing from bashing the car's interior, and saw the deer just standing there, just looking. It raised a leg as if to run. Krepp confronted it. And this is my favorite part. "There is no indication that words were exchanged." He grabbed it by the antlers. The two struggled briefly. Krepp gave the antlers a sharp twist, and the deer went down. He thinks he broke its neck. Krepp then got to the front porch of the nearest house, rang the bell, sat down, and passed out. When he came to, he saw the deer, got angry again, walked over, and gave it a kick. Anyway, the article goes on to say that Krepp is a deer hunter. He even had a deer rifle in his car, no shells. But as it turns out, he had the audacity to ask the game commission people if he could keep the head. Meanwhile, all the animal rights people were calling his employer and the game commission asking that they would collect Krepp's head. Interesting story. There's a man who became unglued. Unglued because something got in his path for what he perceived to be progress. Smashed right into his car. I understand that feeling. It was a couple of years ago, about this time, that our family got rear-ended in our Toyota, and it totaled it. And it was hard. We had not planned for that financial impact. Oh, sure, the insurance covered a portion of it, but to replace the vehicle was more than the insurance covered. What is it in your life that it gets in your way and impedes your progress? What has you down? What is it you're guarding? What are you dealing with right now, this morning, as we sit here? For some of you, the fair market value of your home has gone down, and you realize that if you had to sell right now, it'd be a real tough task to do that. For others of you, you've watched your 401k turn into a 101k. Still others are concerned about your health. There's been a diagnosis in your family, and you're not really sure where that's going to go. The prognosis is uncertain. And you're really not sure if you're building in the right direction, what you can really count on. Others of you just want to hang on to what you have. You want to guard what you have. Your neighborhood is in transition. The crime is going up. And you have to ask, are you going to install any new locks? Are you going to take any measures to better protect your family? For some of you, the way to protect your family is to buy an insurance policy. Can you afford it? Can you reach out? But we are constantly, as human beings, dealing with trying to achieve goals and trying to solve problems, what we move toward and what we protect. This morning, we're going to take a look at Solomon, King Solomon and his rise as a monarch, his method of building, his philosophy of protecting. We're going to take a look at, as he reached the pinnacle of his life, how he actually had incredible internal turmoil. The troubled spirit that he had was remarkable. And then somehow, over time and in maturation, he got beyond that process to a point where he could actually write something like Psalm 127. Let's take a look first at 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. We're going to begin in verse 5. Right on the heels of Solomon making 1,000 burnt offerings in honor of the Lord, we read in verse 5 of 1 Kings chapter 3 about Solomon's vision and then his opportunity to pray. It says in verse 5, at Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, ask for whatever you want me to give you. Solomon answered, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David. Now let's set the context for this. This is a pretty exciting visitation that God is giving Solomon, even though it's in a dream. It's a remarkable visitation, and we see later on in 1 Kings that there's a second time that the Lord visits, and there's just this wonderful personal encounter that he is having with the Lord. This is not Robin Williams popping out like a genie saying, you know, I'll grant you three wishes. This is God laying open the resources of heaven to answer Solomon's request. But notice how he refers to his father. You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David. That's really worth underlining or at least taking note of. Because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart, you've continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? And folks, this gentleman, Solomon, is 20 years old when he's praying this prayer. Now think about that. Can you remember, some of you, what it was like to be 20? Those of you who are 20 are having an easy time. But those of us that are older look back, and we have to capture that time frame. When you're not so far away from childhood, you remember what it was like to be young and to be a kid, and yet you are on the threshold of entering a whole new world where you're going to be saddled with intense responsibilities. Solomon, instead of asking for stuff, asks for wisdom. Lord, help me serve you by serving your people. Give me insight just to know right from wrong. Pretty neat prayer for a 20-year-old, don't you think? Watch the Lord's response. Verse 10, the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, since you have asked for this, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you've not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands, as David your father did, I will give you a long life." Then Solomon awoke, and he realized it had been a dream. Solomon asks for certain specifics. God says, because of your posture, because of your humility, because of the nature of your request, I'm going to give you what you asked for, but I'm going to lather you up with a lot more. I'm going to give you more than you asked for. I'm going to prosper you, and no one will be your equal in terms of wisdom. What a great blessing. Now watch how it plays out. Many of us are familiar with 1 Kings chapter 3, where the prostitutes had a problem between the two of them, a dispute, because one of them had lost a baby. And in the night, the other one had switched babies, the live baby with the dead baby, and they were arguing over the baby in the morning. Solomon, in his wisdom, as it plays out, said, "Bring the baby to me and divide it in half." The real mother came forth and said, don't divide the baby, let the baby live. Solomon knew who the right mother was and handed the baby over. And the people were so impressed with his ruling. Look at verse 28 in chapter 3. "When all Israel heard the verdict that the king had given, they held the king in awe because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice." So we see now the fruition of answered prayer. Look at chapter 4, verse 29. Notice Solomon on the rise here. "God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East." Let me pause there for a moment, just make a comment. As I teach, I am reading more and more textbooks that have less and less to do with holding up Christ as an example and more the appearance of Gandhi as an example. Eastern philosophy, making it into our books on organizational behavior, leadership, marketing. We have lost our Christian ethic in many ways, and we are living in a post-Christian culture, and our publications are showing it. But his wisdom was greater than the men of the East, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. And then he names the heroes there. And it says, "And his fame spread among all the surrounding nations." What does that mean? The paparazzi showed up. No cameras, no motorcycles to trail them, but they showed up and they wanted to find out what was going on. It says here that he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop, grows out of the walls. He also taught about animals and birds and reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. So here he is, a botanist, a zoologist, a writer of wisdom. And people are beating a path to his door. Now, it reaches a pinnacle at some point. We see this in 1 Kings chapter 10. The Queen of Sheba comes to visit him. Now, the Queen of Sheba is an interesting character because she comes from what we would call today Yemen. Now, if you know your peninsulas, you've got the Sinai Peninsula over here, which is between Israel and Egypt. And then you've got the big one that Saudi Arabia is in. Well, right down at the bottom of Saudi Arabia is Yemen. The Queen of Sheba left what we would call Yemen today and traversed through the peninsula all the way up to Jerusalem. Now, if you run the numbers on this and figure about how much she could carry in a caravan of camels and the retinue that she was bringing to Solomon, it works out that you can't get very far in a day's travel. It's estimated that somewhere between 2 to 4 months was the time it took for the journey of the queen to get up to where Solomon was. Now think about that. 2 to 4 months away from your kingdom. What happens in a moment like that? There's no email. There's no fax machine. No texting. No GPS. Say, I wonder whatever happened to Queen, what's her name again? Out of sight, out of mind, she risks a coup. Somebody who's ambitious could have easily stepped in and taken away her throne. Why do we talk about this? Because it's against that backdrop that we see her zeal for wanting to know Solomon. She was so compelled to find out what made this man tick, she said, I'll risk it all. It's worth it to me. The reports I'm hearing are incredible. Let's take a look at the passage. 1 Kings chapter 10. When the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and the relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. It's something to make note of, too. If you prosper and you're successful, people will show up with clipboards, handhelds, digital recorders. They'll want to know the secret to success. So she's there, and verse 2, arriving at Jerusalem, the very great caravan with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. Wonder why? God's supernatural hand was upon him, and the wisdom just flowed. When the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on the table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers and the burnt offerings she made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. Now, those of you that have the New American Standard in your lap will notice that it says there was no more spirit in her. It's as though the animating property of her interior was liposuctioned out. She was vacuous inside. She was crumbling. She could not handle what she was seeing. And she says to the king, the report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true, but I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even the half was told to me. Not even the half was told to her. You realize how upside down this is compared to our culture today? My son and I were in a checkout line at one of the local grocery stores, and they have the racks of all the magazines up there, right? National Enquirer, Star Magazine, all your reputable publications. And Seth says to me, Dad, did you see that headline? It says, George and Laura Bush getting a divorce. George is drinking again. And I said, son, I said, if you peel back that magazine and you start digging around in there, you're going to find out that the half was not told you. It's not true. And it's not going to pass. You watch. In time, it hasn't passed. So, what we saw there was information that when you got closer, was untrue. This is exactly the opposite. The Queen of Sheba said, essentially, I expected to find the deeper I got into this, the more it was kind of played up on the outside. But what she discovered was the half was not told to her because he was every bit as authentic as the reports were out there, and she learned even more the more she pressed in closely. It was Charles de Gaulle, who was the general of France during World War II and later became prime minister, who said in his book, The Edge of the Sword, no man is a hero to his valet. No man is a hero to his butler. No man is a hero to his maid, housekeeper, gardener, whatever the case may be. Why? Because they have such a regular exposure to you that they see your warts, your faults, your idiosyncrasies, your peculiar nature. This is very different. The valets, the butlers, the maids, they loved him. Not even the half was told to me. In wisdom and wealth, you have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness. Flip over to verse 23, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. God kept his word and made good on it. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Terrific story on his meteoric rise. Oh, that we could stop there. But it becomes tragic. Turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Now understand that we are dealing with a king who was at the top of his game. He built the temple that his father David only dreamed of building. Spent 7 years building the temple, 13 years building Solomon's own palace. He was an accomplished builder. He had secured trade agreements with many contiguous nations so that the borders of Israel had been pushed out to the farthest perimeters they have ever enjoyed. The kingdom is as large as it has ever been under Solomon's rule. He has expanded the borders. He has become an accomplished botanist, an accomplished zoologist. He's a writer, and he has all these people coming to him like a magnet. Watch the turn of events here as we look at the interior of Solomon. Chapter 1, verse 1, Ecclesiastes. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Verse 12. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. And folks, you got to think carefully about this. This is code. This is code. How many kings were in Israel up to this time? There was King Saul. There was King David. And there was Solomon. Now we know that King David left Saul in the dust. Solomon is telling us, I beat my dad. I did better than my dad. Different tone. Back in 1 Kings 3, the humble 20-year-old said, your servant, my father, David. Now he says, more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. Dad's not even a footnote right here. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? Watch the personal pronouns in this passage. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under the heaven during the few days of their life. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. Have we heard that refrain? He said, I beat my dad. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well. That is full of meaning there. 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's a lot of women. That's a lot of women. And that's a lot of expectations too, isn't it? Okay? You're married to that many people, you got a lot of expectations on your planner. The delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. Third refrain, I beat my dad. I beat him on building projects. I beat him on harem. I beat him on borders. I beat him on everything. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work. And this was the reward for all my labor. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I toiled to achieve, Everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. You say, wow, he had a rough day when he wrote Ecclesiastes 1, Ecclesiastes 2. This was not just a rough day. This was not transient blues. This man was in deep sneakers. Look at verse 17. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. Wow. He's really hurting inside. You know what he's worried about? Two things. You business people, succession planning. Who am I going to leave this operation to? Who's trustworthy? As I look at my kids, as I look at my grandkids, I don't see the raw material there for being a king. And he's worried. Goes on, he says, and who knows? He says, I hated all the things I had done under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the work into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. Estate planning was a hard thing for him. He didn't know where it was going to go and who he could trust, and he felt that he had accumulated all this stuff and couldn't make a good handoff. He was troubled. And he says what? This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. Despair is a very strong word. This man was dealing with suicidal thoughts. He's on the inside of the pinnacle of the civilized world. The axis of power runs through Jerusalem, and he sits on its throne, and he's caving in on the inside. What brought him to that point? There's some suggestions that we have from Scripture. Look with me at Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17. Fifth book of the Bible. When Moses was leading the people into the promised land, you know, through their disobedience, many had died off. And as he was about to lead them into the promised land, the second giving of the law, which is Deuteronomy, was penned. And in chapter 17, he predicts, or he prophesies, that one day Israel is going to have a king. They didn't have a king yet. All they had were prophets back then. But one day, he knew Israel was going to ask for a king, and the Lord wanted to lay down what the parameters of that king would be so they would brace themselves. And one of the reasons they're going to want a king is to be like all the other nations. Rather than appreciate the theocracy and the direct relationship with the Lord, they were going to ask for some form of intermediary. Chapter 17, verse 14, come the warnings. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us. Be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. And here that comes. Number one, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. Horses and chariots together were like tanks in the ancient world. If you had enough of them, you had power. And we see in 1 Kings that Solomon had 12,000 horses. He amassed a whole lot in violation of this principle. Number 2, verse 17, he must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. I'd say 700 is kind of over the mark there. He must not accumulate large amounts of gold. Number 3. What was the Queen of Sheba bringing him? Gold. What were all the kings bringing him around that came to visit him? Gold. And number 4, Moses says this, and not consider himself better than his brothers. Pride. Pride. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. Pride is essentially competitive. It is competitive by its very nature, while the other vices are competitive only, so to speak, by accident. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good-looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. And Solomon, in his internal world, had to deal with the fact that he was the top banana, and he just couldn't handle all the fame. So there were a variety of things that were working that caused self-deception and caused him to drift. Now, the good news is, I really think we've got a case for making the fact that there was a course correction here. His setbacks forced him to re-examine what was important, what was worth building, and what was worth guarding. And I think we find insight in Psalm 127. So let's flip over there, and that's where we're going to land this morning. Psalm 127, Solomon puts it this way. Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. You'll notice right under Psalm 127, there's a superscription there, a song of ascents of Solomon. Usually we're used to seeing David's name, but it's Solomon. Notice the tonal change. You can just envision an arthritic, palsied hand with a quill in it, penning these words, unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Why? Why older? It's a different perspective. You see any pronouns in there? My, I, me, what I did? No. It's unless the Lord builds the house. I think in some ways, when you look at this passage, we do a disservice to our children when we say, honey, you can grow up and be anything you want to be. Son, you can do anything you want to do. And that's an American, it's woven into our American fabric. We have this mindset of the early founding fathers and the things that they wrote, which we certainly appreciate. But Thomas Jefferson, penning the words, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, we can take that pursuit of happiness and we can twist it out of its context and we can say, you can be anything you want to be. No, no, you can't. You will only be what God allows to happen in your life through providence. It will be that constraint that will limit the parameters of your success. And if we don't acknowledge that, then we get the chance to bump up against reality the way Solomon did. There are points where we need to train our kids to say, as wonderful as our founding fathers' principles were, they must not be misused or misapplied. Solomon understood that. So we need to be careful that we don't buy into the fact that we have any lifestyle we desire to build. We want to have a lifestyle that is pleasing to the Lord and see his hand in it. There's another thing that's interesting here, and it says, unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. I'm not sure how he came to this in terms of the military aspect, but I can picture him spending time with his father David at the fireside. Perhaps David one day recalled to him what it was like in 1 Samuel 24 and 26 when King Saul was in fresh pursuit of King David. David may have communicated to Solomon that I was in the cliffs of En-Gedi. King Saul was coming after me with his 3,000 choice men, the equivalent of our Navy SEALs today. He was coming after us. And I was in the cave, deep hidden inside. And David came in to go to the bath. And when he wasn't looking, turned in the other direction, I went up and sneaked behind him, and I clipped off a piece of his robe. And as he exited the cave, I held up the piece of robe and said, King Saul, King Saul, I could have killed you. And Saul goes through all this emotional trauma and says, you know, David, you're a good man, and says all these things, sounding repentant. Only two chapters later, King Saul is pursuing David again. this time at Hakala. And at Hakala, little different setting, they're all encamped along the side of the road. 3,000 choice men of Israel, along with Saul and Abner, the commander of the guard, are in the center of the camp. The Lord causes them all to fall into a deep sleep. David, up on the hill with Abishai, decides to sneak down into the camp. And next to the king's head is his spear stuck in the ground and the jug that he drank from. And Abishai says to David, "Just give me one shot and I'll pin his head." And David says, "No, we're not going to strike the anointed." But they grab the spear, they grab the jug, they exit the camp. And then David starts to yell into the camp to wake them up. And he chooses Abner, the commander of the guard, the head of King Saul's secret service. And he says, "Abner, Abner." And Abner's waking up, getting the sand out of his eyes, trying to figure out what's going on. And David's holding up a spear, the king's spear, and the king's jug. And he's saying, "You failed to protect the king." And Abner's knees are starting to knock because he knows his job security is really, really iffy right now. And you have to understand, back then, when you got a severance package, the visual was different. All right, so he's very worried, very worried. But that's the kind of reflection that David could have imparted to Solomon. "Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stay awake in vain." The transition here is really interesting because Solomon says in verse 3, sons are a heritage from the Lord. Children, a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gate. Now the picture here is full. Sons are a heritage from the Lord. The Israelite mind knew exactly what that meant. When the firstborn was left in a state, they would get a double portion of the goodies. It was just the nature of the way things went in Israel. And the word heritage here is a way of communicating that the great richness of having children is with you. Notice Solomon's focus has changed now. Before, he didn't know who he was going to leave his estate to. He didn't know he could trust his goods to his children or grandchildren. He was worried about a succession planning. Who's going to run the kingdom? Here, he sees children as very valuable. There's some kind of change going on. It says they will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gates. In the days of old, when you pressed your case legally, you tried it in the gates of Jerusalem. And the elders would be all there to adjudicate what the outcome would be. They would weigh the evidence and all that. If you had your kids, especially your sons, show up as witnesses, it gave great weight to your argument. And it caused you not shame, but confidence in that litigation. So Solomon has this perspective that having kids now is a real strength. They are a true blessing. But notice the imagery here. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth. Have you thought about the property of an arrow lately? We don't use arrows much, I mean, unless you're a deer hunter and you're a bow hunter and you'd like to use arrows. But arrows have a couple of applications. On the one hand, if you are defending a fort for an onslaught, you're under siege, you can pull back the bow and release the arrow to take out someone who's trying to scale the wall. In another application, you can pull back and let that arrow go way far away and hit an object and affect the outcome of a battle of which you are not directly present. That's pretty powerful when you think about it. If our children are our arrows, we are shooting them into the future to touch generations that we won't see, people we will never meet, people that need to hear about Jesus Christ. That's a big stewardship. You say, "Well, I don't have any kids." Oh, but you have arrows. You have arrows. You have missionaries. You have people in seminary. You have a youth group. You have other young lives that you can build into and make a significant difference with regard to how they make impact for Jesus Christ. We all have arrows. In fact, I'm so encouraged by what I see when I look at the scriptures. 2 Timothy 2:2, the Apostle Paul says to Timothy, "The things you've heard in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." It's a forward trajectory. Jesus said, "Go make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit." Missions. It comes from the Latin missio. Missio meaning to send forth. We launch arrows. It took Solomon a lifetime to come around and understand it's not about building structures. It's not about building empires. It's not about just guarding things and hoarding things. It's about investing into people. And we launch them to the glory of God into the future. What's interesting is in 3 weeks we're going to celebrate Easter, the resurrection of Christ. This morning we celebrated in memorial the death of Christ. In Matthew chapter 12, you can look at it this afternoon, Matthew chapter 12, Jesus says, "The Queen of Sheba will rise up one day and condemn this generation because something greater than Solomon was here." He's the only one who superseded Solomon. And he was in our presence on this planet. We celebrate his death and resurrection, and we are to be the arrows to carry that message to a lost world. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you so much for the example that Solomon has given us, for the biography that we see that was checkered at best, and yet still yields for us the fruit of what it means to walk with you and come to the point of wisdom where we realize that our chief investments are people. I ask, Father, that you would help each one of us renew our vision for training young people in this church, for encouraging missionaries and those who want to go into pastoral work, for helping us all to catch a vision for making arrows. Give us a passion for this, Lord, and an excitement about what you're doing right here. In Jesus' precious name, amen.
You've been listening to a sermon presented at Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.